KALW.
So it will actually do, potentially, is to turn our system of government on its head.
San Francisco voters passed changes to police department policies and procedures.
What Prop E will actually do is it puts into place a process that is so onerous that the commission will not be able to follow it.
We learn how Prop E works and what comes next. Then we'll hear about an annual concert celebrating women who make music.
The second year, I thought, okay, let's bring the little girls and teenagers in. Let's pair them with the pros. The press got behind it. It completely sold out. So I was like, whoa, okay, this thing is turning into something.
And we'll hear a reading from the next generation of poets. It's an episode from our series, Bay Poets. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Earlier this month, San Francisco residents voted to pass Prop E, and there's a lot to unpack there. Here's what Prop E will do. It'll weaken the authority of citizen police oversight bodies, make it easier for police to deploy new surveillance technology, like facial recognition. It reduces restrictions on vehicle chases and exempts officers from filing paperwork after using force on a suspect if there are no injuries or if an officer draws their gun. So how did citizen oversight for police work before, and how does Prop E change that? And what does this mean for the future of policing in San Francisco? To bring you answers, we're airing an excerpt from a KALW town hall recorded live at our space in downtown San Francisco at 220 Montgomery. This discussion on Prop E's passage was moderated by San Francisco Public Press executive director and publisher Lila LaHood. She spoke with Max Carter Oberstone, commissioner and vice president at the San Francisco Police Commission, and Alani Balakrishnan, reporter at Mission Local. Lila began by asking Alani how Prop E changes what police are able to do and not do in San Francisco.
It gives them some new powers that they didn't have before. It covers a bunch of different topics. So in terms of surveillance, it gives them access to new cameras that they are able to control, place around the city. It also allows them to... It rolls back some of the policies that were in place, some of the rules that they had to follow. So in terms of use of force, they have fewer requirements on what they have to report. In terms of police chases, it allows them to more readily chase suspect vehicles. So there's a few different categories of new powers that they get.
Okay, thank you. So, Max, the police commission figures prominently in the text of this proposition. I think we have a pretty engaged audience here, but for those who might not be familiar with what the commission does, can you explain your role as a commissioner and how that has changed with the passing of Proposition E?
Sure. So the police commission has two principal responsibilities. The first is over policy development. So it's in charge of approving any and all policies that govern what line-level officers in the field have to do when they're carrying out their official functions, such as, when can you discharge your firearm, for example, and also policies that govern the police department as an institution. So, for example, what data does the department have to make public for inspection, for example. And then the second big category of thing actually happens almost entirely outside the public's view, which is discipline. The police commission sits as a kind of quasi-judicial body to hear the most serious discipline cases against officers. And then in terms of how will life have changed after Prop E, some of it remains to be seen, because Prop E was, as Lila said, it covers a hodgepodge of topics, and it was not drafted with precision, to put it nicely. So I think it remains to be seen exactly what the changes will mean. I think one big change, though, is what was termed community engagement changes, which actually has very little to do with community engagement. Under our current pre-Prop E process, the commission already had a very robust public outreach. process in place that solicited feedback from the public and the community through a variety of avenues and actually required the police department to respond to every single public comment, essentially, that we got for any proposed policy change. So what Prop E will actually do is it puts into place a process that is so onerous that the commission will not be able to follow it. And the only way we'll be able to pass new policies is that under Prop E, the chief, in his sole discretion, can waive this onerous public comment process. So it will actually do, potentially, is to turn our system of government on its head. And instead of having citizen oversight of police policy, we will have the chief of police and the mayor who have primacy over policy decisions.
I'm absorbing what you've just said. So so you're saying that if you can talk a little bit more about this, how could things get stuck? Like how would you not be able to follow through on what's required in terms of getting community input under this new system?
Sure. So, you know, the police commission has no money and it has no policy staff. Prop E requires us to, in a maximum of 90 days, hold 10, before we can amend or enact any policy, we have to hold 10 public meetings in each of the 10 police district stations. We have to meet and confer with the chief of police to identify an impartial facilitator for each one of these meetings. At the conclusion of the 90 days, we then have to meet and confer again with the chief of police about whether we've solicited sufficient comment. And then the exception to all of this is the chief, in his sole discretion, can waive this entire onerous process. We just don't have any staff who will be able to put on these meetings in that short timeline. So I think in practice, what will happen is we will need to obtain the chief's waiver to enact or amend policies. And what that will mean, we'll have to just get the chief's approval before any policy can change, I think, as a practical matter.
Okay, thank you for that. I think we're going to come back to this, but I would like to talk about some of the other changes that will be implemented because of this and sort of the mechanics of things. Let's talk about high-speed chases. How will these changes affect people living in the city? High-speed chases are allowed in many other cities. What do people here need to know practically about what happens during high-speed chases in urban areas? Eleni, if you want to go first?
Yeah. Well, high-speed chases are inherently extremely dangerous. Hundreds of people are killed across the U.S. each year. In San Francisco specifically, I think about a third of high-speed chases result in an injury, almost half result in a collision. And more often than not, the suspect isn't actually caught after these chases. So people think in theory, like, yes, police should chase criminals and that would be great, but people don't realize that this could result in, you know, their child getting hit and killed by a car, whether it's the fleeing vehicle or the police vehicle. We saw a couple big collisions last summer in the Mission District specifically. We saw at 16th and Potrero, a person fleeing from police rammed into a bus stop. Four people were injured. One person was killed. Just a few weeks later, a police cruiser crashed into the storefront and narrowly missed hitting a small child. So going through dense areas, urban areas like San Francisco, it is very dangerous to allow police chases at all, and then to expand them for lower-level crimes, which is what Prop E has done. It will inevitably lead to more injury and more death.
And Max, what was the previous threshold or way that high-speed chases were allowed in San Francisco before this proposition passed?
Sure. So before Prop E, there were basically, chases could fall into one of two categories. The first was for any violent felony, if the person in the vehicle is suspected of committing a violent felony. And the second was a pretty broad category, which the person in the car could be suspected of any criminal conduct, could be a minor offense, but the chase could happen if the officer reasonably believed that there was an imminent threat to public safety.
Okay. So If anybody has follow-up questions about that, we will come back to that. But I'd like to move on a little bit to how this measure affects use of drones and cameras. This feels like a different category than high-speed chases. And didn't we just a few years ago pass legislation to limit police use of surveillance cameras? What has changed, and how has public sentiment shifted for there to be support for this?
Yeah, so in 2019, we passed an ordinance banning facial recognition technology and implementing this process for any city department that wants to use cameras or other types of surveillance technology. They basically just have to propose what their policy is, how they'll use this technology, and get approval from the Board of Supervisors. Under Prop E, police are now going to be exempt from following that process for their new cameras that I mentioned, as well as for drones, which are not being used currently but by the police department, or they don't have a policy in place for it currently. Those will be exempt from any of that oversight that was implemented that San Francisco overwhelmingly supported at the time.
And Max, for proponents of this aspect of the measure, what are they saying are the benefits of allowing police to use drones and have less limits to their use of surveillance cameras?
You know, I guess I hesitate to speak for them because I'm not among those people. I guess what I would say is that the changes that Prop E made in this area were some of the more gratuitous changes that it made because they were clearly unnecessary. The police department has requested to use dozens of different types of technology under the current regime. It has received approval in nearly every case. I think that the killer robot thing was maybe the one instance where they didn't. They've even been able to get it on a very short and expedited timeline when they've needed it. So they just we just got a grant to install 400 automatic license plate readers throughout the city, and they needed approval really quickly in order to get grant funding for it. The board moved swiftly to do it, and they got everything that they asked for. So there just wasn't any need for this. And I view it as one of the aspects that's really more about public relations and sloganeering than it is about improving policy.
Can we talk a little bit about the use of force reporting requirements and why we had the ones that we had before and how that is going to change with these new policies? Who'd like to go?
Yeah, sure. We have a use of force policy in San Francisco, and a lot of the elements of it came from a federal review that the U.S. Department of Justice did into the San Francisco Police Department on San Francisco's request. And one of their big areas of concern was the use of force, and they really emphasized the need for reporting, tracking to, you know, allow for, you know, better analysis, investigation into use of force cases, and general police accountability. So this new change basically lessens some of those reporting requirements that were deemed so important by both the police department, the federal review that's ongoing still. And now this means that if these types of force that are being used, lower level force, are not reported, it's up to the public to sift through body-worn camera footage now, since there aren't going to be reports. And it is a little bit concerning to put that onus on the public to, you know, check what the police department is doing instead of having them present transparently what it is, you know, how it is that they're treating civilians.
Max, is there anything you'd want to add?
Yeah, I mean, to my earlier point, I think that this was another change that was entirely unnecessary. The police commission actually, over a year ago, changed its use of force reporting requirements to make them less onerous on officers. And that's because the police department actually drafted amendments that added additional reporting requirements in the wake of George Floyd that ended up being more onerous than they thought they would be. And when the department came back and said, we want to change them to get rid of a couple things, the commission approved those changes, and we saw use of force reporting plummet after. The important thing about those amendments is that they were done in a thoughtful way. It was a public process. We solicited feedback from a diverse array of people and organizations, and we did it in a way that protected the integrity of our use of force reporting data. Prop E does not do any of those things. And I really am concerned about the integrity of our data, which we rely on to make informed policy decisions in the future.
That was Max Carter Oberstone, Commissioner and Vice President at the San Francisco Police Commission, and Alani Balakrishnan, reporter at Mission Local. They spoke with Lila LaHood, Executive Director of the San Francisco Public Press. We'll have a link to their coverage at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Rhonda Benin is a professional singer and musician and member of the Grammy-nominated Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir. Her experience as a woman in music led her to create an annual Women's History Month concert called Just Like a Woman 11 years ago. The show features a cast of powerful female singers from the Bay Area along with Rhonda, and it happens this Saturday at the Freighton Salvage in Berkeley. Rhonda came to KALW Studios in 2018. She talked to former host of Sights and Sounds, Jen Chien, about why this show is so important to her.
Did you grow up singing?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Did you always see yourself going into music, or was it more of a hobby or more of?
I never saw myself going into it. It was just something that I always could do.
So how did you end up choosing the path?
I got a job at CBS Television in Los Angeles. Because I ran the mail at CBS, I knew everything that was going on in that studio. So I got a wind of an audition for an artist that was on Casablanca Records. I took two more girls that could sing that I knew that worked at the studio, and we went to the audition just as a fluke, and we got the job.
It sounds like a movie.
Yeah, my whole life's been a movie. I quit my job at CBS. I decided that I'd just ride it out and see what happens.
And so when did you come to the Bay Area?
I came here in 1989. Mm-hmm. The two cities are very different. L.A. is more Hollywood, more established artists. Here, a lot of live music. Well, there was a lot of live music in the 80s and 90s. So it changed my view.
Mm. And you decided to stay here?
Yeah. In 2 weeks, I knew I should stay here.
Wow. My blues away. So tell me about your concert, Just Like a Woman. Where did the idea for this annual concert come from?
I was watching a Motown or Stax Records review, and they had all these various acts coming on one behind the other, like Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, Eddie Floyd. So I thought, okay, what if I put together a bunch of headliners? They do two or three songs each at one ticket price, and let's see how this thing goes. I didn't have a dime. I called four other singers. I said, let's put a band together. Let's do it. So we did it. On a Wednesday night, it was half full. I didn't make a penny, but it was good. So the second year, I thought, okay, I'll do it again. The second year, I thought, okay, let's bring the little girls and teenagers in. Let's pair them with the pros. Give them an opportunity to hit a big stage. They get paid just like the pros. Let's do that. The press got behind it. It completely sold out. So I was like, whoa, okay, this thing is turning into something. The third year, I started seeing people repeating coming back, but they were bringing more of their family members.
So they're making it a thing.
Yeah, so it's beginning to be a thing where the grandmother, the aunts, the mama, and the children and the grandchildren are all coming in a group. And so at the end of the show, I'll go outside and kind of position myself where nobody can really see me. And I'm listening to people walk past me singing.
You're doing market research.
And right? Laughing and skipping to their car. And I thought, okay, we got something here.
That must have felt good to see how it made people feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how this show started. Women write music. Women play instruments. Women sing.
Oh, and as you've shown, women also produce and figure out how to get it done.
Yes. Yeah. It's so hard to call if people are going to come.
What kind of argument would you make for the power and the importance of a live musical experience?
I think to be in the place. I've been in some situations where, oh, thank God I was there, because the magic just came out of nowhere.
Do you have a particular memory like that you want to share?
I was coming from a gig, and I stopped at the 57th Street Gallery, which is no more. And it was the drummer James Levi's birthday. So I thought, okay, I'll just run in here on my way home. And it was packed, and I was in the back, and there were horn players in the back. And I heard them back there playing, and I looked, and I saw, and I waved. The horn players came out, and they started playing a line of, "You're Still a Young Man." And the real
Tower of Power.
Yeah, and the real singer.
Rick Stevens.
Rick Stevens, who had been in prison all those years for murder, who had just gotten out of prison. And he came up and he sang, "You're Still a Young Man." And the room went up in complete smoke. Everybody in that room sang every part along with him. It was one of those times where it was like, whoa, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
I'm getting chills just hearing about
it.
That sounds amazing.
Pretty chilling. Yeah, it was something. So those kind of moments.
So people get out to live shows.
Yeah.
Because you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
That was singer Rhonda Benin speaking with KLW's Jen Chien in 2018. Rhonda's show, Just Like a Woman, is this Saturday at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. Find more details at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This Friday, the San Francisco Public Library is partnering with Youth Speaks to hold the semifinals of their Teen Poetry Slam. So today we bring you an excerpt from a former Youth Speaks poet, Ariana Brown.
I have never needed a country to love me, just Black people. I have never needed heaven, just Black people. Eddie, Alexis, Michelle, T, you gave me permission to love being Black. Who taught you to love the texture of your hair and the color of your skin, the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to love yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to love your own kind, the race that you belong to, so much so that you only want to be around each other, to be what God gave you, beautiful because we chose to be, together because we're better that way? When I tell you no one in the world makes me love like Black people, makes me laugh like Black people, I mean it's the first thing people notice about me. It's the first prayer I wake to and the longest song I I am grateful to sing. Should I ever be shamed inward for wearing a dark cloud on my head? Should I ever think myself better for being a lighter color? Let me remember the dark utopia from whence I come. Should I ever forget that Black people have demonstrated the greatest acts of humanity, of courage, that we are no one's second choice, that no matter where they put us on a map, we will find each other, create our own worlds, and they will be enough. Let us be enough.
That was an excerpt from For the Black Kids in My Eighth Grade Class by Ariana Brown. The Youth Speaks Teen Poetry Slam will be held tomorrow at the San Francisco Public Library on Larkin Street. Tune in Monday morning at 11. We'll get an update on Oakland's search for a new chief of police.
Oakland is at the center of the East Bay. It's basically the driver of the region, whether you like it or not.
A conversation with reporter Ali Winston from the Oakland side, Monday morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.